Teachers and administrators in the Shawnee Mission School District remain split over a new contract, and the fallout from the impasse could impact districts throughout the Kansas City Metro. After months of failed negotiations, the Shawnee Mission School Board opted to impose a three-year unilateral contract without the approval of teachers. One group said the district's decision will have long-term consequences that will have devastating effects on a community built around its schools. Among the issues, pay, class sizes, and the number of hours a day that teachers are in front of students. Now, a conversation with two members of the Shawnee Mission School Board who will talk about why they approved a new contract without the support of teachers. With us, Board President Heather Ousley. Heather, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And former Board President Brad Stratton, who's also a member of the board, is also here. Brad, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Steve.
And I want to point out, we reached out to the teachers' union, but it declined to send representatives to the show today. Heather, how difficult a moment is this for your district?
Well, I think it's a very difficult moment.
Sure.
I don't want to underestimate or say that we haven't considered the serious ramifications. We did what we needed to do to make sure we had a good contract that provided good compensation and tried to thread the needle on both compensation and addressing workload. And that was ultimately the only way to do that was with the 3 years.
Brad, in your view, what's the one big reason why the administration and the teachers can't come together on a contract here?
It's being able to agree on the finances that are provided to us by the state of Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
When the legislature and then ultimately the courts of the state of Kansas allocated new funds to try to get to a level of adequacy funding within the state,
right.
Shawnee Mission received $9.6 million this year we're in currently. Next year, it's $2.9 million, and the following year, it's $5.6 million. So those are three numbers that we know we can begin to budget for. Unfortunately, during the negotiation, the ask was more than that. Ultimately, our contract that we put forward and voted on as a board gives 79% of the money I just described back to the teachers in their contract.
Mm-hmm.
The State Department of Education was saying as much as 50% would be a good goal. We were able to put together a plan that gives 79% of the new dollars to the district back to the teachers.
I want to be real clear about that new money coming in from the state, Brad. It's $9 million more bucks this year. Next year, you get the $9 million plus $2 million more.
Correct.
And the third year, you get those two increases plus on top of the $5 million, right?
That's right.
Okay.
There was a misconception that when the first year was 9.6, that it just is a straight line up. And that's the part that we wanted to make sure is that, and that's part of the reason we went with a three-year deal, is because the fact finder put in the report that the numbers that were brought forward at their negotiations were not feasible in a two-year deal. And so that's why we went with the three-year in order to capture those additional dollars in the third year to give the level of compensation increase that we've done.
You know, Heather, given the fact that you're at an impasse here, both sides split, can't come to an agreement, why not go with a one-year contract? I'm speaking just generally here. Why not go with a one-year contract and take a break and come back maybe late in the year or in the spring and try this again, given the bad feelings that are so apparent in the district right now?
The two major issues that were brought up consistently, both at the table and then in the boardroom, were it's not enough compensation and workload has to be addressed. That is what our folks in the classroom are saying, is that this is just an untenable level of workload. And the only way—
Is it untenable? You hear about teachers in front of students most of the day. That's unlike lots of other districts. The Shawnee Mission School District has a great reputation as a district that does education right. My own kids went through it.
Yeah.
And, you know, teachers are saying they're overworked.
I'm going to take them at their word for it. I mean, they're the education professionals. They're the ones working with our kids. If they're coming to us and saying 6 out of 7 is too much.
6 out of 7 periods a day in
right.
front of students you're talking
right.
about.
Right. If they're going to say, you know, as an English teacher, if I have 6 out of 7, then I have that many more kids I'm grading. I have that many more kids that I have to be staying on top of. I don't have that plan time. I don't have that collaborative time with other educators to make sure I'm where I need to be.
Some teachers saying they have 180 students a day.
Well, that's
a lot of students.
That's the 6th class.
Mm-hmm.
And in planning on doing that type of workload reduction to get both sets of secondary educators, both middle school and high school, it's estimated $5 million to hire 70 new teachers to do that. And in order to be able to get to having that $5 million, you've got to be able to budget and plan the finances that you have in a way to do it responsibly and sustainably so that we don't get ourselves in a situation where we've started to address and then run out of money and have to do a reduction in force, and then we haven't accomplished what we set out to accomplish.
2 points here. I want to point out the fact finder did agree that with the district that the NEA's proposal was overly aggressive to meet reasonable budget objectives of the district. That's on one side. Brad, some context here, though. During Governor Sam Brownback's administration, your administration went to the teachers and said, we need some help. We need you to pick up a 6 hour a day in front of the students. And so when times were tough, the teachers agreed to pick up that 6 hour. Times are better now. Can you make an argument that they're owed it?
I will say that from what we've learned about what takes place in the classroom, we owe it to them and we owe it to the students. What took place during the previous governor's administration, we're aware of, interestingly enough, of the seven of us on the board, five are new in the last 2 years, and myself, I've been here four, and then one other colleague, eight. So although we're very aware of those agreements
that were
made. You
weren't there at that time.
We weren't there at that time, but that's not to say it's not a reality. And so we've been very conscientious of making sure that that's addressed. And that's why in this final contract that was presented, we also addressed workload in the contract and offered up some language around that. As was stated multiple times, in June, our superintendent, Dr. Michael Fulton, will produce a report that says this is the first step on how we're going to work towards that. As Mrs. Owsley just talked about, it's a pretty expensive proposition to reduce that workload. So we're 100% in. We want to do it. We want to make sure we reduce the workload. The one thing I'll add to this, and this is, we hear about mental health issues constantly with what is going on in our school districts. When I talked to one of the teachers in one of our high schools, and they said, the other thing I miss is not only that extra time, but the time to engage and get to know my students better.
Right.
I play this quasi role of also being a counselor in the building. That resonates with me as a board member, too. I think
the joy of teaching, to some extent, has been undercut here.
That's right. So by no means did we not want to speak to that. We wanted to do it. And as Heather mentioned, to thread the needle to be able to do both in a tight budget, being responsible for the funds that are provided to us in this funding formula at the state.
But by going with to 3 years, Heather, the fact finder recommended 2. The teachers were at a 1-year extension. By going with the 3, isn't that a signal that any prospect of good relations with your own teaching staff are effectively over for at least in the immediate short term here?
Well, to begin,
they see it that way.
The offers on the table at the time were both 3-year offers. So the Education Association had a 3-year offer on the table, as did the district. I think the ability to do what needed to be done in a 1 year simply wasn't there. We're already through the 1 year, basically. I mean, we're 7 months into it.
Right.
And as you noted, the fact finder's report, we were trying to track as closely to the fact finder's report as possible, and he was recommending using third year dollars to help address the compensation increases mm-hmm. over 2 years. Well, if third year dollars are already committed, then at that point, the district, I mean, we're willing to meet them at the 3-year in order to get to the workload. So if we can make it where at the third year we can get to the workload adjustment, then at that point, we're willing to enter into the 3-year to get that done. I mean,
this all gets tough for a lot of listeners, I think, to hang on to because there's so many moving parts here. Mm-hmm. I want to point out that Chris Sindrick, president of the nonpartisan advocacy group Kansas Families for Education, said this about the current arrangement with the 3-year unilateral contract. This decision, Brad, by the school district will have long-term consequences and devastating effects to a community built around its schools. What's your response to that?
I have 2 responses.
Again, whether you feel you're right or not here, mm-hmm. the foundation of the district seems to be wobbling.
Mm-hmm. I'll begin by saying my hope is that as we work through this process and the public, including the teachers, but the broader public as well, looks at the contract and digests the terms of the contract. Many of these statements were made when the unilateral contract was voted on. And I get it. The phrasing that I heard from folks is, what did the school board do to the teachers? And that's what I hear in that quote. But what we want to do by proactively speaking and talking about what's in the contract, hopefully it'll become a conversation about what did the board do for the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
There's an 11% increase in total compensation over the course of the 3 years.
Including now, benefits you're talking about.
Because in this case, no. No, that's just the compensation part, because a lot of times there's the 1%, there's the 1.25%, and there's the 1.5% over 3 years. That's the base. Step and column is also a term that's used to increase and reward for both tenure as well as education. So again, we're talking about averages. We talk about the fact that in the state of Kansas, we have the highest average teacher compensation. And of course, everyone will apply that to their own personal situation. Say, well, not me. Well, we're dealing with average compensation, because in the end, we're trying to make a decision on behalf of over 2,000 teachers.
The teachers, Heather, say that the compensation in Shawnee Mission is high. One reason is because you have a lot of veteran teachers. You have a lot of veteran teachers who have master's degrees who become entitled to get higher pay. Is that your view as well, or am I missing something there?
Yeah, we have some of the best teachers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've always valued having teachers that went on and completed their master's, and the salary schedule reflects that and how it's been set up to help benefit those folks who get additional hours even after their master's. But one of the other things I'd like to add is to kind of finish some of what Brad was saying there, is that we are a precedent-setting district in the state. And the issue with workload, we know we've talked to other districts in the state, and I mean, that is a consideration. If 6 out of 7 is working in Shawnee Mission, there are other districts in the state that are like, hey, if they can make it work and they're still an excellent school district, then there's no reason why we can't try that out if we have financial issues. So I think
it's Shawnee Mission still an excellent school district?
Yeah, absolutely.
Based on?
I mean, if you look at the success of our students, the success in test scores, the success just in what we're able to provide for kids to make them college and career ready.
But the argument then becomes, you have teachers saying, I got 36 English AP students in a classroom. I got 180 students a day coming through that I have to deal with. How can teachers be successful and effective in an environment that is arguably overloaded?
That's why we went with a 3-year contract to do those workload adjustments.
To bring it back.
Right. And mm-hmm. if we don't do it, then it will spread. I mean, this in my mind is what's on the line. If we can't make that commitment in the contract to adjust workload and know that that commitment is out there, there will be other districts that will follow suit and move to 6 to 7.
And that's why you're saying, just to be crystal here, that you wanted a 3-year contract because you wanted to include that workload reduction.
Yeah.
And signal to teachers that that's where you wanted to go.
Yes.
Okay. Brad, why aren't other school districts in the metro, I'm not hearing this in other districts, why is Shawnee Mission seemingly standing alone here?
I think there's a whole host of reasons. I'll speculate on a few. One of them would be the very fact that we are currently the highest compensating school district in the state of Kansas. So we are the bar. And so there could be pressure from around the state that says, if we can get the bar raised in the Shawnee Mission, then all boats will rise. That's fine. We just have to deal with what's before us as board members of Shawnee Mission. I think the other part is, as we continue to deal with angst that's built up both at the state level and the local level, we stepped into this role as volunteers to be the correction to that angst, and it takes time. My colleagues that were elected 2 years ago, we have 2 more new board members that were elected this past year. I hope that the public will understand that none of us are a greedy corporation. None of us are trying to figure out how to get money back to shareholders. We're trying to make sure that we get as much money back into the teachers' compensation pool, back as much into the classroom as possible. But at the same time, we have to be good stewards of that. I understand that angst is still out there. That's why we're out here proactively talking with you and others to make sure that we're able to better explain. The negotiating process was very frustrating for us as board members, mm-hmm. because we have to allow the legally statutory driven process to play out. It was really hard as a board member.
And it's not like as a board, you can go to the state or the governor or your state legislature and say, hey, can you send us a few more bucks? The formula is what the formula is, right?
That's right. And I want to make sure that the public knows that, because there is legislators meeting right this very moment to determine future budgets. That's where the extra effort should be put towards advocating for public education. All 7 of us are very tenured, experienced advocates for public education. We're not in here to do anything other than to get the best outcome that we can from our classrooms and making sure that our well-qualified teachers are compensated for that. I think we miss the opportunity when the energy is focused on Shawnee Mission and say it should be focused on Topeka. There's an opportunity to really affect not only what's happening this year, but then there's also an election in November that's very important.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the split between teachers and administrators in the Shawnee Mission School District over a new contract and what that means going forward. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Let's go to Karen from Overland Park. Karen, you're a Shawnee Mission taxpayer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm not only am I a taxpayer in Shawnee Mission, but I was a teacher in the Shawnee Mission District for a good number of years. And I retired 5 years ago, and I was one of those teachers who had six classes a day. And 5 years out from my retirement day, I'm still repairing my health. It took a terrible toll on my health. And I think it cannot help but do so when you have teachers who really care. And I know that I have a lot of former colleagues who really care about what they're doing in the class. And 6 hours a day over time, it's really tough. I found that I was working for many, many more than my 40 contract hours a week. And I did it gladly because I cared a lot about what I was doing. But, you know, I've heard all of these arguments before from these current board members. I heard them 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Right.
I don't see what's changed, honestly, except that Topeka does not give as much money toward education. And I do understand that. I'm not saying the board members are totally off base, but it's just untenable what they're asking the teachers to do.
Hmm. Karen, I appreciate your points. Thanks very much. Let's go to Krista from Shawnee. Krista, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the Shawnee Mission School District, the contract impasse now underway. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Krista.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I was Shawnee Mission School District, and I was raising my own children in the Kansas side of the city until my daughter was in second grade. And she wasn't reading well at all, in my opinion.
Right.
And when I brought her into Shawnee Mission Schools here, she goes in Lenexa, although we live in Shawnee. They got her back up to speed immediately. Like, her reading went from what I thought was poor to excellent within a year. They pulled her out of school every single morning for specialized education in this subject, and they still do this with her. She has math, and I couldn't be happy.
So you've had a good experience with the district, it sounds like, Krista.
Yeah, and I think the teachers do whatever they want, personally.
Okay. You're breaking up a little bit. I appreciate the phone call, Krista. Let's go to Josh from Lenexa. Josh, you're on Up to Date.
Hi.
Hi, hello? Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. Great, thanks. So, yeah, I'm in Lenexa. I've got a kid in the Shawnee Mission School District, and we love the teachers are outstanding. And I also think that what we looked for was, in the previous years, the school board, we would see them with so many problems. I mean, you'd see national news here on NPR with them being approached by the ACLU. So we really, really hoped that there'd be some new school board members, much like Ms. Owsley. And this is, I think, what we're seeing now is the process of that being fixed, that being cleaned up. And unfortunately, this contract appears to be a difficult one to do, but it's also, if you look at the fact finding, all the stuff from the fact finder, this contract seems to meet or exceed all of those things. And I may be wrong in this, but I think we're already in year one of those 3 years. So really, our big problem.
That's what Heather Owsley was saying, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah, looking at Topeka and saying, hey, do we have to keep going to the state Supreme Court to adequately fund our schools, one? And two, this is what we're just going to, like, I feel, even though, like, I want everything for our teachers, I think what I want for our teachers are the things in this contract and then more and more cleanup of the previous administration. We don't need iPads and AR-15s in our schools. We need our teachers to be well-funded and the money to be put there.
Josh, I appreciate your comments. A couple of final points here. The decision, Heather, leaves teachers with three options: accept the contract, continue to work under last year's contract, or resign without penalty. Do you have any sense in the early going, since this impasse has been publicly announced, which option you expect the teachers, or which option the teachers are taking here?
Well, I think it's really tricky to have me say what I think the teachers are going to do in this situation.
But do you know what they're doing yet?
No, not really.
Okay.
It's
too soon.
It's too soon, and I think people are waiting and seeing how some more things play out before they commit to signing the contract. And I have had a couple people reach out privately and say, I plan on signing, but I plan on waiting until later in the game, just so as to provide as much solidarity with one another as possible until the end. So,
Brett, is there any opportunity or opening for continued negotiations in the short term here, or have we reached an impasse and there aren't any prospect of negotiations going forward?
Yes, the discussions with the Teachers Association will continue. This isn't a stop talking for 3 years and we'll see you in 3 years.
And are those discussions continuing?
They are as we speak. Dr. Fulton meets on a regular basis with the leadership within the Teachers Association. Those conversations are ongoing, because if you think about it, how many staff people there are in the building, there's constantly issues that need to be brought forward, and it's a great avenue for the district leadership to learn from them. By no means do we want to discount the important role that they play in representing the teachers of the school district.
You know, Heather, Linda Seek, the president of the National Education Association Shawnee Mission, the teachers union, told the Star and has warned of a mass exodus of teachers who may leave to work in nearby districts that offer similar pay but perhaps fewer instructional hours each day. How big a concern is that for you? And again, are you seeing any signs of that occurring yet?
Well, I will say that the workload adjustments, that was the concern and why we addressed it in the three-year contract. So I think that if you're asking the risk-benefit analysis of the three-year versus not fixing workload adjustments, we're in the same spot of having folks potentially not want to continue with us. And so my hope is that by providing year-over-year compensation in a way that everybody gets that compensation, but we do address the workload issues for secondary educators, that is the best that we could do. And I hope that they are able to see that this was not punitive, that this was our best at a good contract.
And just clarify, so in year three, what does the contract that you're imposing offer when it comes to workload adjustments?
So it phases in workload adjustments in 22-23, and we know we won't...
Back to five, or what does it do?
Well, that is the part that is going to be presented.
Five classes a day,
right,
is what I'm saying.
Right,
yeah.
And that's the part that will be presented by Dr. Fulton in a few months. Before we made the move from five to six, the numbers show that about 40% of folks were teaching six out of seven. And so it's not a guarantee that all of a sudden now everybody in the district is working five out of seven. And because it has to be phased in, we have to be looking at what is the most productive and healthiest way to phase it in. Is it like, okay, our kids in middle school are going through a lot of emotional transitions, let's address middle school first?
Right.
Or is it, you know, our core curriculum folks, like our English teachers and our math teachers, their workload is just, you know, too high. And so we need to address it for those folks at both the middle and high school level. And so the language in the contract is permissive in that it says that the superintendent at his discretion may begin to phase it in, and then we'll have the reports from the folks looking at what does that phase in look like.
Gotcha.
To present to the public in a few months.
One more phone call. Rich from Overland Park. Rich, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I work a lot with high school students outside of the school. I help them with their science and math problems. And the teachers I know tell me they all are just counting the days till they can retire. Number two, there's an excessive reliance now on computerized teaching so that the teacher doesn't have to stand there hour after hour droning away same information, same remarks, just utter exhaustion. And last comment, what about the Shawnee Mission School Foundation? It raises money privately. Can't some of that money go back to the schools to help reduce your costs and...
Can't you have a private fundraising program in addition to the state? Very interesting question, Rich. Brad, take that one.
I'll be glad to speak to that. As a former president of the Education Foundation for the district, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out a way to do that privately, especially during those lean years during the legislative, I'll call it, cuts during the 2012-2016 period.
Right.
The district's budget is about $275 million a year. The foundation has a couple million dollars in it. So it's really just a stopgap to fill some holes. We made appeals through the foundation as best we could to say, folks, I know that the legislature is not applying as much as they should, as the court now has determined. Can you help us out? We aggressively raised money within our community, and the community was as generous as they could, but we're talking just a couple million dollars. One thing I'll add to that is that foundation has really switched or even focused more on making sure that there are scholarships for students to continue their education. So not only dollars in the classroom.
In higher education you're talking
about? In higher education, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's a real focused effort there too, because you've got to get creative when it's raising funds to support public education.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Board President Heather Owsley for coming in. Heather, thanks very much.
Thank you again.
And former Board President, current Board Member Brad Stratton. Brad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
We'll stay on top of this story going forward. After a short break, when we come back, we'll talk about a history of Black women in America. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Neither Senate trial nor Chiefs celebration kept my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, from making its appointed rounds to inboxes across the metro. You can sign up at kcur.org/Kraske, and you too can get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. It takes just a minute, actually seconds, to subscribe. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. On Monday, we'll talk with public radio host Diane Rehm about allowing those who are dying to put an end to their suffering. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the history of Black women in America stretches back farther and covers a broader array of people than many of us imagine. That and their unique ability to make their own communities while overcoming centuries of oppression is the central theme of a new, highly praised book, A Black Women's History of the United States. The book charts what the authors describe as the incredible journeys of a range of women, from the first Black woman to walk in the continental U.S., to those who were enslaved and freed, to others who made their mark as activists, artists, and even those who lived outside the law. One common theme, these are women who push past daunting obstacles to live lives decidedly less ordinary. Another theme, their contributions too often have been overlooked. With us are the two authors of this book, and of course we're having this conversation in the midst of Black History Month. Dinah Ramey Berry is a Regents Professor of History and Associate Dean of the Graduate Education Transformation at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Berry, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Kaylee Nicole Gross is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Kaylee, it's nice to have you too.
Thank you. It's actually Callie.
Callie, I'm sorry. You're right. I'm misreading my notes. So nice to have you, Professor Gross. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Dinah, why was there a need for a new history of Black women?
Well, Dr. Gross and I were both at UT Austin at the time, and we were having conversations about courses that we teach because there are a number of studies that have come out before this. But we felt like it's been maybe 15, 20 years, and there's been an explosion in scholarship on African-American women and African-American women's history, not just in the U.S., but across the diaspora. And we thought that now would be a good time to write this book and to put context and to provide some depth to a variety of women's lives.
Professor Gross, you two describe the history of Black women as people who have charted courses, and I'm quoting here, where the incredible, the fantastic, and the triumphant meet, mix, and mingle with hardship and terror. I mean, that's a mouthful. Tell us just a bit about how these journeys have been incredible and fantastic.
Oh, wow. Thanks. This is a great question. You know, we told the story through individual Black women. Each chapter opens mm-hmm. with a vignette. And so each figure, I think, sort of sketches a lot of that arc. If we take, for example, Aurelia Browder, this is one of the women who actually protested segregated busing in the same year that Rosa Parks did, mm-hmm. but actually did so before her.
Yes.
She ends up you know, standing up also and actually giving her name to one of the lawsuits against this case. So she is, you know, an everyday Black woman in America working, raising her family, but also having to confront this injustice, not necessarily as a seasoned activist, right? But it's just sort of an everyday person right. kind of riding the bus, headlining this case that also helped to ultimately, you know, break the yoke of segregated busing in Montgomery. But there are also women like Augusta Savage, who was an artist in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance, who lived this life of moving from being a young school teacher who was married, I'm sorry, a young person who planned on being a school teacher, who was married in the rural part of Florida, to, you know, shedding that life, bringing her daughter with her, referring to her daughter as her sister, becoming an artist, getting a degree at Cooper Union, you know, and like living this whole other sort of cosmopolitan life in the city. In the 20s and 30s, at a time where we don't imagine women being able to sort of change and sort of chart different destinies. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it wasn't a life without struggle. She founded a center for artists in Harlem, but in pressing for the funds to get that from the government, she also faced a political backlash and was actually removed from leading that institution.
Wow. So that's where the fantastic and the triumphant mix and mingle with hardship and terror. There's a phrase. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm finished. Go on.
You know, there's a phrase I wanted to ask you about, Professor Berry, because it really jumped out at me. It's the motto of a school headed by a woman named Nanny Helen Burroughs. And she said of the school, "We specialize in the wholly impossible." I mean, what a phrase. And Nanny, you say, is the embodiment of someone who could push past daunting obstacles. What do we know about her?
Well, first of all, the phrase is a very important phrase and one of the things that we wanted to put in here. We were trying to put as many Black women's voices in and their stories in the text as possible. We wanted them to speak for themselves and for the reader to really encounter their experiences from their voices. And when you think about that, that could have been the title of this book, but it has been used in other studies that have been done by African-American female historians. Black women have had to go over and accomplish great things over severe obstacles. And I think when you think about creating a school and you think about some of the obstacles that Black women face, like Nanny Helen Burroughs, it is that they're specializing in the wholly impossible.
Huh. Professor Gross, what do you mean when you two write that Black women occupy a complex, paradoxical relationship in America? We are at once marginalized and ostracized, yet our very being has been exploited to help create and maintain white supremacy.
Wow, you don't throw out any softballs, do you?
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, you wrote one of those books, Professor. I'm just trying to get there. Yeah.
Okay, so what we mean by that is, you know, African-American women, particularly if we think about the legacy of slavery, right, or enslavement, Black women's bodies have literally been commodified to swell and create the wealth in this country. Right. So not only were women themselves enslaved, but also their offspring were enslaved. This helped to sort of fuel the riches and the wealth that built the country. At the same time, Black women in sort of every conceivable aspect are among the most marginalized, you know, throughout history as well as now. We live below the poverty line. We're disproportionately impacted by adverse health effects. Black women are also underprotected and over-policed, have some of the highest rates of HIV and AIDS. And so there's this way in which, on one hand, Black women have always sort of contributed to the nation. If we think even about 1812, a young indentured servant, a Black girl, Grace, you know, Wisher, actually helping to sort of, you know, sew the flag,
right.
You know, to, you know, Black women like Shirley Chisholm, you know, running for president in the 70s, right? There are all these instances where you have Black women playing sort of key roles in the history, whether, you know, at their, you know, out of their own sort of will or, you know, being exploited. But at every turn, I think the way mainstream society looks at us is negatively.
Can I add to that?
Please.
As well? I talked about this recently, and it was a research experience. Even in the writing of this book, we were searching for Black women in the archives, trying to find original stories of women that people maybe had not heard of. And I had found a record of an enslaver who had asked for his enslaved people to be returned because he had allowed them to go fight in the American Revolution or mm-hmm. go support the war effort. And he said that in that group, there was 7 men and 1 woman. And so I contacted the archive and was trying to get information about this one woman to see if I could find out her name or... And the archivist said, there was no women in that group. There was not a woman there. And I said, well, your descriptive inventory on your website says that there were 7 men and 1 woman. I'd like to buy this particular document. And I was working with the research assistant at the time, and they were giving us the runaround. And I said, I'll just go ahead and let me buy the document, send it to me, and I'll take a look. So I got the document, and of course, it's as big as day. It says 7 men and 1 woman.
Huh.
That if I had not pushed beyond that, we would not have been able to include that in this book.
But how difficult was it to research some of these women, given one of the points you make is that so many of these contributions have been overlooked over the course of decades?
I think if you go to the archive and to sources looking for women and trying to tell their stories, they're there. It's just scholars have chosen not to include them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of the way you focus and the kinds of questions you ask, because even though we may not have testimony, direct testimony from them, even though we may not have their names, their stories are still important for us to tell. We have
right.
lots of women in this book that we would say an unnamed woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's all, an unnamed Black woman. But it doesn't mean that she didn't contribute to American history.
Right. Well, you all mentioned, go ahead.
I just wanted to add really quickly, one of the other things that we did in the book was to really try to use sources that folks could also easily access and follow up themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of instances where we cite from documentary collections, documentary films, record lyrics, just a variety of sources that help to center and feature Black women's voices, but that also, if readers are curious about, they can actually go and find those sources fairly easily themselves. Because
mm-hmm.
we also wanted to really inspire people to do more research into this history.
You know, you guys mentioned Shirley Chisholm, and obviously the presidential race is in full bloom again. So I wanted to ask you about her. You know, she decided to run for president in 1972, and in doing so, she becomes the first Black major party candidate to run for president and the first woman ever to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. I can't help but wonder, why did she do it? I'm not sure which of you wants to take that one.
You know, Shirley, I mean, I'm happy to, and Dr. Brer, if you want to jump in,
mm-hmm.
Please do so. One of the things that I love about Shirley Chisholm is that she started out with wanting to sort of demonstrate that the country was better than the limitations that we put on ourselves,
mm-hmm.
right? That she wanted to push past this idea that someone wouldn't vote for a candidate because she wasn't male or because they weren't white. So she wanted to test those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And she even says at the end of her life that she wanted to be remembered as someone who was a catalyst for change.
Hmm. Professor,
right?
Professor Berry, she was running against 8 men. Was her candidacy largely symbolic, or was it more than that?
I don't know. I think it depends on your interpretation. I think there's a great documentary by Shola Lynch, who did a piece about it and has footage of her. She was optimistic the entire time, even though she faced statistical odds, right? She still kept pushing forward, and she was very serious about her campaign and wanted people to take her seriously. I think it could be, we could look at it today and say it was symbolic, but I think it's phenomenal that she did it, and it's important. The thing that surprises me most is how many people never knew that fact, don't know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised today when I teach classes and I talk about this, we show the film, we do some research on her, and students are like, I never even knew this. People think Hillary Clinton is the first woman to run for president.
Huh. So, Professor Berry, you think she deserves more than she's getting these days?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So interesting. Another woman you chronicle in this book, and maybe it only makes sense because it's the way the book begins, is a woman named Olvera Isabel de Olvera. Professor Berry, who was she?
Isabel Olvera was a woman of mixed ancestry. She was part African. Her father was African and her mother was Indian. She lived in Mexico and she filed a petition. This is how we find out about her. She filed a petition to the administration, like the city government in Mexico, and she asked to be allowed to go on an expedition to what now is contemporary New Mexico. And in that petition, she said, "I am neither bound by marriage nor slavery," which I thought was quite interesting. But she also ends it by saying she needs this piece of paper so that when she travels with this group of people that are going and exploring parts of what becomes the United States, she wants people to know that she's not enslaved, she's not bound to a man or the institution of slavery, and that she has a right to be there. And mm-hmm. she knows that people will be, quote unquote, disturbed by her ancestry. And so at the end, she says, "I demand justice." Hmm. And we thought that was such a powerful way that one of the first women of African descent that we could identify, who we know walked the soil of the United States, the first thing she came into this country asking for was justice.
Yeah.
And we're in that same space today. There are lots of women demanding justice of all different races, but I feel like we've kind of come full circle, and we thought that that was a great place to start the book.
Hmm. Professor Gross, even before Olvera traveled to New Mexico, there's a mention in the book about another black woman who made her way into present-day Kansas around 1594. One thing we do know about her is that she nearly lost her life after being badly burned in an attack near Wichita. Do we know much more about her?
You know, not a huge amount more. I mean, that's one of the things that is also difficult. And we talked about this in terms of the methodology, that there are points where the record can be frustratingly incomplete.
Right.
But the fact that we have the fragments that we do still allow us to at least document their existence and to point out that they, you know, did some incredible and amazing things.
Right, right. You tell another story, Professor Berry, about 10-year-old Mary Colbert, who hid something in her apron one day during the Civil War. Not surprisingly, the story begins, she's frightened by the sounds of war. It's a great story. What happened to her that day?
So the troops were coming through to the house. The Yankee troops were coming through to the house, and the family members, the women that were still there, the white women that were still at the house, gave her all their valuables, their money, their jewels, everything, and told them to put it in her apron. And as the troops were tearing up the house and looking for the family possessions and looking for things like money and jewelry and so forth, nobody even looked at her. No, they didn't even consider that Mary would be carrying the family records, the family wealth. Literally.
I thought that was so striking, and so striking that the family even knew ahead of time, hey, let's give the money to Mary and have her hide it because they'll never suspect her.
Exactly. And she says something like, and they never even took a second glance. And that's a theme that we find in black women's history. It's like we're trying to have people take multiple glances at African-American women who have contributed to the United States history. Women like Mary, who may not have made it into the record if we weren't looking for stories about the Civil War that were unique, that we could tell to bring in and show that black women were present and actually had a major impact on this history.
Professor Gross, you write that it wasn't unusual, and I didn't know this, for soldiers during the Civil War to have a black woman as a personal slave. What can you tell us about that?
You know, I'm going to ask Dinah to speak more about that because she is so much deeply ensconced in the material. So I actually want Dinah to
take this
question.
Yeah, Dinah, go ahead.
Sure. We also have a colleague who's just come out with a book about women during the Civil War, and that's Dr. Thavolia Glimpth at Duke University. But one of the things that we found is a number of enslaved women were in these military camps. washing clothes. Some of them, like Susie King Taylor, were serving as nurses. They were tending to the troops. Some of them were cooking food and handling injuries. So there were Black women on the front line seeing and witnessing, you know, all of the terrible aspects of war, but also in their own way contributing. And I would argue, without having full stories, I would argue that some of them wanted to show their citizenship. This was an expression of their citizenship. And there are a number of them that had absolutely no choice and were forced to go because they were enslaved.
We're talking about a new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States. How about Ellis Coachman, who pushed against her father's desire for her to be dainty and to sit on the front porch? She went on to become the first Black woman to win an Olympic gold medal. And she did this back in the 1948 Games. What can you tell us about her?
Right. So Alice Coachman is also another one of these sort of unsung figures. We know about her, I think, within the fields of history, but she's not widely known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was pushing against these gendered boundaries that, you know, sort of prescribe Black women's athleticism. And Black women especially were really concerned about their comportment in public, because Black women also were vulnerable to all kinds of attacks, and you have a lot of negative stereotypes about Black women being immoral. So Black parents were especially careful about raising their daughters to be respectful and to comport in a way that would be socially acceptable. So having this young woman, you know, running around in the dirt on track and fields really sort of alarmed her parents. You know, she was punished a couple of times. It really wasn't until she started breaking records and winning that people sort of realized that this was a thing that she could do as a young woman. And then she took it and went all the way to the Olympic Games.
And again,
brought home the gold.
These names like Shirley Chisholm, Alice Coachman, you wonder, they've been lost to history and to some large degree, and you wish sometimes and wonder why they have been. I want to thank my two professors here, the co-authors of this, again, highly praised book, A Black Women's History of the United States, very accessible. Kelly Nicole Gross joined me. She's the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History out at Rutgers. Dinah Ramey Berry also is with us. She's a Regents Professor of History and Associate Dean of the Graduate Education Transformation at the University of Texas, Austin. Thank you both very much, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
You passed the public radio test. Tough questions. You all did good. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
On Monday, we ask why Missouri lawmakers are working to repeal the Clean Missouri Redistricting Initiative passed by voters last November. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.